We're continuing with Parashat Ki Tetzé, where we had left off with the mitzvah that when a person speaks badly about his wife, when he says lies about her and wants to divorce her based on those lies, so Motzi Shemra, right? We discussed that? Yes, we discussed it? We didn't discuss that he says that she cheated on him between the engagement and the marriage.
Yeah.
So then he has to remain married to her, and he cannot divorce her unless she approves. The Torah forbids him from divorcing her. We have a mitzvah that Beis Din should apply executions in accordance with the mitzvahs of the executions, each death penalty in accordance with the order the Torah says, which sins deserve which execution. We have a mitzvah that... when we have a camp, we go out to war, so we set up a special place in the camp, which is a bathroom. Meaning people shouldn't just relieve themselves wherever they want. There has to be a set place where people go. And this is part of the idea that our camps are considered holy camps. Right. V'yamachanecha kadosh. Hashem says, Ki Hashem italech bekerev machanecha. I'm in your midst. Now this concept, at first glance, is when we go out to war. Halachically, its applications are way beyond that. The halachic applications are that you cannot say anything holy in the presence of feces. So this morning, my son did a fast one on me. He decided he's going to play a trick. So the one-year-old pulled off his diaper when it was full, and I was in the other room, and started running around the house. So now, I have to clean up. I don't only have to clean up because it's filthy. I have to clean up also because I can't say a blessing in the house. I can't learn a word of Torah. That's this week's parsha. When there's any feces around, you're not allowed to say a word of holiness. You're not allowed to learn anything. You're not allowed to say a word of prayer, a word of Torah. So that's this idea that your camp should be holy. We say a person's area is his camp. His four amos, the four footsteps that surround him, are also considered his camp, and that's supposed to remain holy. Hashem is with the person in that. Now, another application, the Torah says, Lo yireh b'chayil v'tavar. God does not want to see something that's immodest, something that should be covered. And from here we have the halacha that when a person is undressed, a person may not learn Torah. When a person is in the presence of other people who are undressed, he may not learn Torah.
What about davening in shorts?
So, for a man, so long as his private parts are covered, that's okay. Technically, if a man is in underwear, he can say blessings. When it comes to davening, so then with regards to davening, we're supposed to treat it with more respect. We're standing before the king. But technically, halachically, the bare minimum, here we're talking about biblically, the bare minimum is that a person's private parts are covered. We have a mitzvah that when the soldiers go out to war, they each have to have a shovel with their battle instruments so that they can dig. And when they relieve themselves, they could cover up, they could remain clean. It's a good question. Bichlal, the question is, do the mitzvahs of an army apply to Tzahal today? That's a good question. That's a broad question. Shehako. We have a mitzvah to fulfill what we say. So if a person takes a vow, he has to keep his vow. A person gets an aliyah and he says he'll give a donation, he has to give that donation. We have criterion when something becomes a vow. The idea of a vow is I promise I'm going to do it, and I promise it by God's honor. That's the idea of a vow. A neder, a shvua. And we have mitzvah to fulfill those now. The Torah doesn't want us to take on vows. The Torah gives us that capacity, but it's much better not to take vows. That's why we ordinarily say, bli neder. I'm not accepting this as a vow. I'm saying it, I'm going to do it, but I'm not accepting it as a vow. We have a special... That's a broad question that deserves a broad answer. You have that twice in our parsha, right? With Eishes Yifas Tor, you have that too. So you see...
You needed some...
I understand because you have, like, you're in war, and you're a young man, and so, like, it's kind of hard to control yourself, but, like, do they really have that special type of, like, do you have like a
Let's see if at the end we have time. Remind me to come back then, okay? We have a special mitzvah. Then might be sooner than you think. They want me to go quickly here. We have a special mitzvah that when we hire a worker to work with food, we should allow the worker to eat from that food. Just like you're not allowed to muzzle an animal as it's threshing, it sees all the food and it's, it wants to eat, you have to allow it to eat. So to a human worker, he's dealing with food, so you have to allow him to eat. Now, he doesn't have to stop his work and eat. During the lunch break, he should eat. He shouldn't go, he shouldn't come to work with bags. Now I'm going to bring home lunch and supper, and he's going to eat at the workplace, but do it in a normal way.
So you have to provide your work for food?
You don't have to. There's a certain benefit that the boss has a mitzvah, the owner has a mitzvah to allow you to eat from the food when you're working with it. There's a mitzvah if a person wants to get divorced. How do we do that? So the Torah says you write a legal document. There's a contract called a get. A get is the numerical value of 12, right? Test is 9, gimel is 3, 9 and 3, 12. A get traditionally has 12 lines to it. And we write this legal document in which there must be severed all contact between them. Meaning, if he tells her, I divorce you on the condition you never drink a cup of wine. So technically, the divorce should be an act. So long as she doesn't drink a cup of wine, they're divorced. But you understand the game in that. Because if one day she wants to renege on the divorce, she could drink a cup of wine and now they're not divorced anymore. So the Torah says divorce only works if it's sefer krisus. The Torah says, I want you to cut off completely. You're divorced, it's over, it's finished. Now you have a mitzvah to remarry her, provided she doesn't marry someone else in the interim. There is a mitzvah. So long as one is not a kohen, there's a mitzvah to take back one's divorcee. Yes?
Can I ask a question on that? Theory or an answer to, I guess, re-explain the role of the wine and what all that...
I'm saying you can make a divorce. Technically, you could have any contract with a condition. You could stipulate, I'm divorcing you on the condition that you won't make $1 million. But if you make $1 million, I want you back as my wife. Then I'm not divorcing you. So you can stipulate a condition so that indefinitely we'll be standing in doubt. I divorce you on condition that you die first, that I die first. That if you say I divorce you on condition that within the next year you don't make $1 million, so then you see at the end of the year she didn't make $1 million. Okay, but if you leave a condition which makes it that we will never know if she's really divorced or not, or there's a way out of the divorce, so that's not good. The Torah says, I want a sefer keritut. I want a book that, I want a legal document that cuts off between you. She has to go her way. Now, the Torah did not want a situation where people were exchanging their wives and doing all kinds of improper things. So the Torah says, if she ever marries someone else, you can't remarry her. Now, you understand the logic, because otherwise people, there were cultures. This was happening during the time of the Torah and during the time of the temples. And I'm told it's still happening today in certain cultures, that people exchange wives for a night, for a week. People do all kinds of immoral things, and the Torah wanted to prevent it. So the Torah says you can divorce her, and you have a mitzvah to remarry her, provided she doesn't marry someone else in the interim.
Did you ever heard about somebody who remarries his divorce?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. There's
Moshe's
a famous
parents.
Story about that.
Moshe's parents.
Ah, there he gave
yeah,
you.
Yeah, but I mean like in our days.
Moshe Ben's mm-hmm. parents?
Yeah.
Really? There's a famous yeah. story which I really don't like, but if you want, I'll tell you.
Really?
The story goes that there was a learned person in New York mm-hmm. who divorced his wife and then remarried her. So someone came over to him. This is a true story. They say it's true. Someone came over to him and said, well, if you divorced her, then why'd you remarry her? So he said, well, for a first wife, she was no good. But as a second wife, she was fine. Yeah. Now, there's a lot of truth to that. That's why it's so hurtful, because he shouldn't have said it. Meaning after you get divorced and you suddenly see what you get to choose from on the second go-around, so then you look back and you say, hey, wait a second, she's not so bad. I'm not going to get that much better this time.
We don't
want
to hear the story of Moshe Rabbeinu and his parents
I think divorced. It just said that the first in the
first. They got divorced and remarried, sure.
Is in the Torah?
Well, the Torah says, ve'elech ish mibet Levi ve'ikach et bat Levi. There was a Levite who married the daughter of a Levite. And our tradition is that was Amram who had divorced his wife because of Pharaoh's decree. He said, there's no point in remaining married, no point in bringing any more kids to the world, we already have to, bye-bye. So he divorced him. And then his daughter came and told him, you're worse than Pharaoh. because going your route, there won't be any girls either. There won't be any continuation. You have to remain married. And he said, you're right. And he remarried his wife. Remarried Yocheved. Yeah.
So the Torah doesn't want us to get it conditional. Didn't David's men when he went out to battle have conditional? That like an acceptance to one of the imams?
No, that was with a limited time condition. If I don't come back from the war within 3 years, you're hereby divorced today. So that's a condition, like we said, that has an end time. You know at some point she is definitely divorced.
There is an end time.
Right, if it's finite. So we have a mitzvah. When a person gets married, the first year he's supposed to stay home. He's not supposed to go out on any long journeys or excursions or on a voluntary mission for war. He's supposed to be home to keep his wife happy, to be happy with her. Special mitzvah. They have a good question. It's a good question. But technically, that's the mitzvah.
It's a mitzvah. But is it the violation?
This was a mitzvah in the time of the temple. This was a mitzvah that when the city chose to send its volunteers to a voluntary war, so then you go. One can argue whether our army today is doing voluntary wars. Really, everything the army does is supposed to be a milchemet mitzvah. It's supposed to be just to protect us from being annihilated. You know, so that doesn't fall under this. That the Navi says, Yeitzei chatan mechedro vekala mechupata, for a war that's... a war, what's it called? Of
that?
No. And there's an English word when
expansion.
Opposite. Not a war of expansion. A war that's
intensive. You're trying to translate
into existential. That's the word. A war that's existential. That they're threatening our existence. So there, the Navi says that you even take a chatan and a kala out of the chuppah. Because it's existential. What are you going to do? It's an existential threat.
And I think, isn't it better to...
But again, halachically, you have to discuss what the status of the state is, what the status of the army is. Meaning it's not so simple to just say, because it's existential, it's milchemet mitzvah. It deserves a broader discussion. We have a mitzvah that when we take collateral, we should give back the collateral when the person needs it. A person says, I need a loan. So you say, okay, what are you going to give me as collateral? He tells you, I'm a taxi driver, I'll give you my taxi. So even though you're not supposed to ask for collateral, something that's his livelihood, but if he volunteers it, so then the Torah says, you have to give it back in the morning so you can make a living. So every night he gives you the collateral, every morning he comes and picks it up. So that he's not going to be too happy doing that. Eventually that'll force him to pay up. He doesn't like leaving his taxi by you every night. But there's a mitzvah to give him back the collateral when he needs it. We have a mitzvah to pay wages on time. You hire a painter, so if he finished painting by day, before nighttime comes, you're supposed to pay him. You hire a babysitter, she finishes babysitting that night, before the sun rises the next morning, you're supposed to pay her. We have a mitzvah to pay a person's wages the day he expects it. So sometimes you have a hired worker where he only expects it at the end of the month, or that's the deal, so that's okay. But there is a mitzvah not to withhold wages, not to be late in paying wages. Special biblical mitzvah.
But if you say to somebody, you want to pay him in the end of every month.
If that's the agreement at the beginning, that's fine. We have a special mitzvah if we forget bundles of wheat in the field, not to come back and take them, but rather to leave them for the poor. That's a mitzvah of shichacha. It's the one mitzvah in the Torah which you cannot perform intentionally. It's a mitzvah that's predicated on forgetting. You forgot a bundle in the field. That's how you perform the mitzvah. We have a mitzvah that if one transgresses the prohibitions of the Torah, so then we have guidelines, but a person can end up getting lashes if he's forewarned and he still does it. So then the courts will evaluate what he's healthy enough to get, and if he really did it, it has to be an active prohibition. There are many criteria, but at the end of the day, one can get lashes. Yes?
Regarding the lashes you said about forgetting wheat in the field, does that just mean, if you forgot it, that you're not allowed to get it back to sell it or to eat it, but could you, retrieve it to do something else with it?
Nope.
But you're just not allowed to touch it?
You leave it for the poor. If there are no poor around, so you could collect it for the poor, and you'll give it to them later.
Or sell it and give the money to the
I guess you could do that too. That's a machlokas tanaim, but to the best of my recollection, the halacha is like that, that you may do that too. Yes, so how do we give lashes? So, why is this relevant, 39? How do we give lashes? So this is relevant to now, because there's a custom that people give themselves lashes before Yom Kippur. Each one gives his friend, you take off a belt, and this is to commemorate what happened then, in case the person deserves it. We don't do it hard, it's just the thought of it. So, a person is bent over a chair, and let's see if I remember this. It's one, two on the back, and one around the front. It's sets of three. That's and as he gives the lashes, he says the following pasuk: Vehu, rachum, yichaper, avon, velo, yashchit. And he is merciful. He is willing to forgive sin. He is not destructive. Vehirpa lashiv apo. He will return his anger plentily, meaning often and as much as necessary. God is willing to take back his anger. Velo ya'ir kol chamato. 13 words. Right? And he will never arouse all of his anger against the person. So 13 words, because 39 is three sets of 13. So today I haven't seen that many people doing this custom, but it used to be the custom that on the eve of Yom Kippur, every person would bend over a chair and ask his friend to fulfill it. And as they give the lashes, the person confesses what he's done wrong. So that's a very exciting thing to undergo, if you guys ever do it. What?
I never knew that we had some mortifications.
Well, at the end of the day, it doesn't really hurt. It's just the idea of it. I'm saying it doesn't hurt the way we do it today. In the times of the court, where a person was forewarned, and he was told, don't do X, and if you do it, it's a biblical prohibition, and then you quote him the pasuk, and you tell him, and if you do it, then you will get lashes. And then he does it, so then he would get lashes, and then it would really hurt. They had a court.
There's
what?
No such thing as actually just like, oh, let me do it for tshuva.
So here, you see, we do it for tshuva.
Yeah.
Right, but not as a painful thing, but rather as something that arouses a person to do tshuva. And the person, as he's getting the lashes, he confesses to his creator. So today we say, Oshamnu, Bagadnu, Gazalnu, etc. But, right. I did it once or twice, just for the experience, and it's a powerful experience. Yeah.
They don't like
Right. It doesn't hurt. I'm saying you're not doing it for the... Yeah. But it's an exciting thing to do. It's, you know, a lot of what we do is speech and thought. And when you actually do an action like that, it has different meanings. I can tell you that I asked someone who I held in very high regard, because I felt like he would take it seriously and do it with the right intent. You don't want someone who's laughing as he goes, boom, right? That doesn't quite cut it, right. We have a mitzvah of Yibum, that if a person passes away without children, there's a mitzvah that his brothers should marry his widow. And then the Torah says that the children they will have will be a form of returning the soul of the deceased to the world. They give a continuation to the deceased. We have a custom that under such circumstances, the child that would be born is named after the deceased. The Talmud tells us in Moed Katan that if a family lost a family member, and then within the year, a new baby was born, so that's considered like a sign from heaven that Hashem is comforting the family. So that's, here it's...
And then they give the name of who?
So very often they give the name of the deceased, yeah. That's
the
person who passed away, the deceased.
Ah,
so in Yibum, now you did. Today we don't do Yibum. Our custom is that we don't do it anymore, because we don't have the proper intent. There's a whole discussion. Technically, we have to realize that a brother's wife is biblically prohibited. Meaning if a person's brother married a woman, and then the brother passed away, so she is prohibited to the point where a child from her would be a mamzer. She is prohibited just like a sister is prohibited. The only instance where she's permitted is if the brother passed away without children. But there have been instances where people had children and then passed away, and then their brother married the woman. The next children they have are mamzerim. No two ways about it. That's a biblical prohibition of kares. The Torah prohibits marrying a sister-in-law. She's as prohibited as an aunt. She's as prohibited as a sister. She's as prohibited as a married woman. And even though the brother passed away. So that's not permissible. Even if the brother passed away without children, today our custom is that we don't do Yibum anymore. What we do is Chalitza. That's the next mitzvah in the Torah. What happens if the brother wants to marry his widowed sister-in-law? Meaning when she's left childless, so he says, I don't want her. So then there's a mitzvah in which the courts get together and they have this whole procession where they make a declaration. He didn't want to. She comes before the courts and says, you know, my brother-in-law didn't want to marry me. And then she takes off his shoe and spits in it. And the idea is that and that's after they do that procession, so the court declares her free to marry whoever she wants. Technically, prior to Chalitza, she's not free to marry whoever she wants. She's supposed to marry her brother-in-law. What's the idea? Oh, so Moshe Rabbeinu sees a burning bush, and God tells him, take off your shoes, you're in a holy place. What does it mean, take off your shoes? So the word shoe is representative of a type of glove. And a glove is also called a shoe in Hebrew. So in ancient Hebrew, the word na'al also meant kfafa. Meaning in modern Hebrew, we call a glove a kfafa. But in ancient Hebrew, in the book of Ruth, it says, shalaf ish na'alo v'natan l'reyeyu. They did the exchange because he took off his na'al and gave it to him. So you think it means he took off his shoe? Here, have my shoe. Let's make a deal. No. He took off his glove. They made the deal with the glove over there. So the word na'al could mean a glove. The word na'al could mean a shoe. Now, the word na'al really means an encasing. So the word na'al and the shoe are representative of the idea of the body as an encasing for the soul. Here the brother was supposed to offer his brother an encasing for the soul. We just said that if he would have married her and brought children to the world, he would have given new representation to his lost brother's soul. He says, I don't want to. So the idea of taking off the shoe is, you are the one who removed the shoe from your brother. You're the one that, and spitting is a form of scorn. This is, you were unwilling to do it.
So why don't they do it?
Remind me, we'll get back to it, I hope. Okay? Some Yemenites and others still do Yibum. Our custom is that we don't.
The children wouldn't have any problem.
No. We have a special mitzvah to save a person when someone's trying to murder him. Special mitzvah. Now, the idea is like this. We have a concept of rodeh. This mitzvah is performed every few days or weeks. You know that. Where is it performed? In the hospitals. Sometimes you have a scenario where a baby is threatening the mother's life. So today we have it less and less. But we view that baby, it's not his fault, but he is actively threatening someone else's life. The Torah teaches us when one person is threatening someone else's life, you save the person who's being threatened. And you try to save him without killing the person who's threatening his life, but if you have to, you kill the person who's threatening his life. So the baby in halacha is referred to as a rodeh. The baby is, here he is, he's threatening the mother's life, and today we can get around almost every instance where he's threatening the mother's life. But not every instance. Every so often we have situations where it's either the mother or the baby. So long as the baby wasn't born yet, so he's the aggressor. And he doesn't yet have a right to anything. Once the baby's head is out, so the halacha, even in the Mishnah, it's already discusses, when is he considered living? And once his head is out, once he starts coming out, so then we don't get involved. It's survival of the fittest. Sometimes you have a situation where they'll both die. That's a different story. But these are tough questions. But this is where this halacha has practical applications today. It had practical applications when sometimes you had Jewish mafioneers, right? You guys heard of that, right?
Jewish mafia?
Yeah. You know, you don't know there's a Jewish mafia. Okay, so yes, there are unfortunately Jews who also have taken up a life of crime, and you can have a situation where a person is threatening someone else's life. You better know the facts. I mean, sometimes it looks like someone's the aggressor, and really they're not, so you shouldn't be quick to pull the trigger. And we always try to maim the person before we kill them. That was the claim against Avner. Avner was being chased at war. We will learn this Bezrat Hashem next semester. He was being chased by Asoel, and Asoel wouldn't let up. So Avner told him, how am I ever going to face your brother? I'm going to kill you if you keep running after me. Go chase someone else. And Asoel said, no, you're the general, I'm after you. And he couldn't shake Asoel, and so he took his spear and stuck it through his fifth rib and killed him on the spot. And later on, Asoel's brother Yoav avenged his death, and he tricked Avner and killed him. And his claim against Avner when he took him to court was, he said, if you were so sharp that you could hit him with one shot and kill him, you could have maimed him for the same price. You could have hit him in a way that he couldn't keep chasing after you, but you didn't. So even though he was a Rodef, you're right, he was chasing you, but you could have avoided it another way. You should have shot him in the leg. So that's the mitzvah of Rodef. At the end of the parsha, yeah.
Wouldn't the brother not need the justification to like that because he has the right to kill him because of the city of refuge?
No, because it wasn't, he didn't kill him by mistake. He killed him on purpose. The whole city of refuges went by mistake. Here,
wasn't he during a war too? Like war.
Right, but it was the end of the war. Right, but it was after the war, and Avner was running away from the war, and Asoel was chasing him.
part of the war?
That's a good question. You know, I never looked into it. I'm telling you what my logic dictates, based on the Gemara, but I don't remember a place that your question is actually addressed. Where is it considered during the war, and when is the war over, and it's a personal vendetta? You know, he was chasing after him, and they were no longer during the war. But I'm not sure what the answer to that question is. Where do you draw that line? I don't know. It's a good question. We have a special mitzvah to remember what Amalek did to us. That they were first to come and attack us, even though we did them no harm. They had enmity for us, and Hashem gives us a mitzvah to remember it. and then we have the mitzvah to go to war against them, to destroy them. So that's in a nutshell the mitzvot of the parasha. We have a few mitzvot we skipped. There's a mitzvah that a man should not wear a woman's clothing. Included in that is that men should not shave their arms and armpits and legs and wear women's jewelry. There are things that are feminine that women do. Man's not supposed to do them. Man's not supposed to wear women's jewelry. A woman's not supposed to wear men's clothing. We have a mitzvah not to leave something that will cause other people stumbling blocks. We have a mitzvah not to plant kilayim, meaning two types of plants together with a vineyard. And if someone does plant, let's say, a cucumber or a melon and a grape in a grape orchard and a vineyard, so then the food becomes prohibited.
We can't eat it. We can't eat
it. If a cucumber grew up in a vineyard, no. So that's a different question. That's the next generation. That's the plant that comes from it, or chutz la'aretz. But if someone crossbreeds, we said with a vineyard. We didn't say any crossbreed. Kilei akera. Right. So long as it's not with a vineyard.
Yeah.
We have a mitzvah not to do work with two different animals. You can't attach to your wagon an ox and a donkey at the same time.
What about having in your house a dog and a cat?
That's not a problem. You could even take a donkey and a mule, a donkey and a horse, and put them in the same corral with the intent that they will mate, so long as you don't physically mate them. We have a mitzvah not to wear shatnez, meaning if you buy some expensive suits, so they have wool and linen together, and that's biblically prohibited. Shatnez is wool and linen. We have over here, 5-minute walk from here, they have cleaners which will do the job for you. They'll check it for you.
Oh, they can check it there?
At the cleaners here on...
the same street as
up there? Yeah. They give it to a guy who checks it. Okay. Mr. Rotnemer.
Does it take long?
2 days? You could go directly to him. He lives up the block. You go directly to him. He lives 2 houses after the light on your right.
Are you allowed to wear a linen shirt and a wool jacket?
Technically, yes. Practically, it's a little more complicated because you could have hairs that mingle and get caught, and then it becomes complicated. Technically, that would be okay, 2 separate garments. practically it's not so pashut. Just like it says you're not allowed to have, let's say, a linen pillowcase with wool inside. It encompasses it. So I gave you two answers why it could be a problem.
It's only a prohibition on wearing, not just having.
Yes, about wearing. One area where this has come up in recent years, I don't know how prevalent it is in mattresses that are brought in from Europe. There was a time that the mattresses were made of wool and linen together, shatnez, and that's why here in Israel you could find mattresses that have been approved, that they've been checked, that they don't have wool and linen together. And being that the Torah describes shatnez as something that should not be upon you, so from that we understand that it means any form that it's upon you. Even if you sink into the mattress and it envelops you, that's also called upon you.
What about sleeping in a hotel?
How often do you check clothing? I mean, that I have to check it.
Depends which clothing. So you know that shirts, I don't think anyone's ever found shatnez on shirts. If you have a linen shirt, then maybe we have to find out. You could call these places, find out if they sew the button with wool thread. That might be, I don't know. I don't know if a linen shirt is an issue. You know that if you're buying pants, for example, that are 100% polyester, you don't have a problem with them. If you're buying a shirt that's 40% cotton, 60% polyester, no problem. If you're buying a suit that's 100% viscosa, you have no problem. If you buy a suit that has wool in it, so then the custom is that we check. If it's an expensive suit, you must check. If it's a cheap suit, so then the custom has become that we do check.
What if the employee says,
right, so that's been found to be sometimes true and sometimes not. I personally was at a store just before the 3 weeks, and he told me, we always said we check, and then we were caught that even though we checked, some of our stuff was shatnez. The Jewish seller told me, we always said we check, now we don't say we check anymore. We do, he told me. But we don't dare say it anymore because we were caught. We had checked and somehow it didn't work. So he was honest with me. I asked him, and most sellers are willing to take it back if you'll find it was shatnez. I make them put it in writing, but I don't buy suits that are that expensive. I've never had a problem. But if you're going to buy a suit that's $500, $700, then you really have to check.
Yeah, I have one suit I really want to check. Do you have the address of this one?
Second house on your right after the corner, Rotnemer family. You pass the light, you go straight,
yeah.
On your right hand side, the second building. Okay? Okay. We have a mitzvah in the Torah that you're not allowed to punish a person who had something, that something happened beyond their control. So the Torah says it in the context of rape, that you're not allowed to hurt the girl, you're not allowed to do anything to the girl, even though she might not have been 100% in the right. You know, she might have been tantalizing, she might have been enticing, she might have been she went to a place where it was only him and her, and she did things that might have been less than appropriate, but at the end of the day she was raped. And so the Torah says you're not allowed to do anything to her. And from here we learn a concept that whenever something was done that was beyond a person's control, you're not allowed to take them to task for that. It's not their fault. We have a mitzvah that a person who is a eunuch, a person who cannot have children, may not marry a regular Jewish girl. Now, there are different forms of this. One of them is a krut shafcha, a person that got sliced in his male organ. So whenever he wants to go to the bathroom, it all dribbles out. So he can't really ejaculate. So that, even in the days of the Talmud, they knew how to fix it. And once they could fix it, so then he was allowed to marry. We have a mitzvah that a mamzer, a bastard, someone that comes from an illicit marriage, if his father married his sister, if his mother was a married woman when they got married, so there wasn't any real marriage there. There are all kinds of, if it's a prohibition of kares, and then the child that ensues is a mamzer, and even though it's not his fault, he has to marry a girl like him, or other loopholes, but he can't marry a regular girl.
He can marry a girl.
Oh, so that's what I said, are all kinds of solutions.
But it says for 10 generations, right?
No.
No?
Forever.
Forever.
Yeah.
Like their children will be also not children.
Correct.
Wow.
Correct. And that's what King Solomon says.
Wait,
the tear.
How do we know it nowadays? Like
someone else. I mean.
What?
The whole line of David. And
why?
No, that was a Gyorah. She was a Gyorah.
What do you mean? It says from Moab, no? Lot and his daughters. So doesn't that make him the line of Mount Zerim?
Well, didn't we? Here we're talking within the Jews. Who says Goyim have Mount Zerim? It's a good question. I mean, it's a prohibition. But that doesn't make him into Mamzerim. It's two questions. It's one of the Noahide laws. Lot and his daughters transgressed the Noahide laws. But that doesn't mean there's Mamzerim. Wow. I wasn't ready for that one. It's interesting how every year you get questions that... Not every year. But this year I'm getting questions I never got before. Okay. He said Lot married his daughters and from that came Moab. So then isn't the whole Davidic dynasty Mamzerim? Okay, so the answer is because they weren't yet Jewish. So Mamzer is only within Judaism. If someone's not Jewish, that's not a problem.
So if there were people who would technically be Mamzerim, but they were born in Egypt and then were freed and given the Torah, then like they start fresh despite the fact that they have like Mamzerim.
Correct.
Ancestors.
That's why Moshe isn't a Mamzer. Otherwise, Moshe would be a Mamzer too, because Moshe's father married his aunt, which is biblically prohibited. It's a little more complicated than that because it's not clear that's prohibited or no, but okay. Okay, we have a mitzvah in the Torah against prostitution. So the idea here is that technically a person will say, if the girl goes to mikveh, so if she and I want to be intimate, what's wrong with that? The Torah says, no, you have to marry her. You can't just sleep with a girl. A girl can't go and say, I'll be with him today and with him tomorrow. Biblical prohibition. She'll say, I'm willing to forgo my ksuba. The Torah came and protected me, so I'm forgoing all my rights. The Torah says, no. Biblical prohibition. You're not allowed to allow prostitution in our midst. So part of the responsibility in that is that a parent is responsible to marry off his daughter. A parent is supposed to help his daughter out, get her a nice dowry, get her nice clothing, get her to look nice, get her nice guys that she should marry. Because the nature of things is that people have needs and people have desires and you have to meet those needs. You can't just say prohibited and I'll make it work. You have to help them resolve it. We have a mitzvah in the Torah not to accept an etnan zonah. What's an etnan zonah? So when a person hires a prostitute, he gives her either payment and sometimes he'll also give her a gift. So let's say he gives her he's okay from even though they were wrong, but being that it's not an isur kares, we said it has to be a prohibition that the Torah says is punishable with kares. It's forbidden with a lot. It's forbidden as a regular prohibition. Then you have certain prohibitions that have another weight, where the Torah says he who does it gets cut off from the Jewish people. Those relationships, the child that comes from them is usually a mamzer. There are some exceptions, but usually a mamzer. A kedesha, a woman, say, have a lot of people who they don't get a legal marriage. They don't get a halachic marriage, or they don't even get married, and they have kids. So even though that's not the ideal way, spiritually they didn't do any act of kindness to their kid either, but at the end of the day, the kid is kosher, and he could marry and everything. Yeah.
Question. Tamar solicited Yehuda. As if she was a prostitute, so then how is that okay?
You're right, it's wrong. But it was prior to the giving of the Torah.
Yeah, but back then people, like we heard like at least five times since I got here that back then people were so like spiritually healthy that they just lived the Torah.
That's a very nice question. No, there are multiple answers. I'm just trying to think which one. Would you be comfortable waiting till we got to that parsha so that we could address it for 10 or 15 minutes and not just for two?
I'm down to wait. I'm a patient person. I actually just want an answer. Like are we gonna discuss this like that in the future?
We usually do. We'll get there, Mitzchim, in 2 months. We'll be up to that parsha.
I'll be patient.
But Chazal agree with your question. Meaning, the question is addressed in the Midrash on the spot. And even Maimonides, when he begins his book on marriage, he begins by discussing how did the world look like before the Torah was given, which is unusual for Maimonides. What do I care what the world looked like before the Torah was given? So you see that Maimonides was also on some level addressing this basic question. Wait a second. You're talking to me about the holiness and the importance of marriage, and yet the source of the whole Davidic dynasty went with a prostitute, or what he thought was a prostitute. Okay, so remind me, but I usually address it. I mean, it depends on where the guys take me in the class, but that's it's on the agenda. So here the Torah says that a gift that was given to her is prohibited from being offered on the temple. So a person, she says, look, I've done so many things wrong, I want to offer a gift. The Torah says, no, stuff that came from that is disgusting for Hashem, he doesn't want it. So this is an important concept, because very often we like to have what's called in modern Hebrew a fig leaf, that people try to cover what they've done wrong. Adam and Eve go and eat from the forbidden trees, and then they take some of its leaves and they cover themselves with it, as though that's okay. That's not okay. And that's what the Torah is saying. People sometimes, you've heard of Madoff, right? So he's a huge donor to charity. It's very good. It's all stolen money. So that's there are a lot of people who want to do that. Now, this is an idea that we have to keep balanced, because the flip side of it is that sometimes a person says, I've done so many things wrong. What's wrong if I do another thing wrong? God doesn't even want my mitzvot, you see? That's not what we said. We said that if you're going to take the thing that's a sin, you're going to take the money you stole and say, okay, I'll give my tithe from it. God says, don't give me the tithe and don't go stealing. Obviously, just because you stole doesn't mean you shouldn't keep Shabbos or Kashrus or other things. there's a story of a young man who grew up in a home that was non-observant, and then he came to Israel and started learning Torah, and then he got married, and his father would eat pork and do everything that's prohibited. His father said, look, son, you're learning Torah in Israel, I want to support you. So the kid comes to his Rosh Yeshiva and he says, I don't want to take my father's money. I could manage on what we're living. And my father, he smokes on Shabbos, he eats pork, he's living a life that's totally contradictory to the Torah. How can I take his money? So the Rosh Yeshiva said, so you're telling me your father eats pork, right? Yes. You're telling me your father desecrates Shabbos? Yes. You're telling me your father has many sins that are on the book? Yes. So you're also telling me that he has one chance for a merit and you're going to take that from him too? You know, he's trying to do one thing right. Don't take that from him. Sometimes we take this idea the wrong way. So on the one hand, don't take a sin and try to make it okay by giving a donation. That doesn't make the sin okay. On the other hand, that's no excuse not to do things that are kosher. Yeah.
What if someone is a drug dealer and gives like masa? Like, is that kosher masa?
There's nothing.
It's a tough question. I wouldn't want to touch it, but I don't know. I don't know. When King David was in the middle of a battle, so the Philistines were hiding among different piles of grains of the Jews. And he wanted to know if he's allowed to just burn down the fields so they wouldn't have places to hide. And he says, that night he tried to analyze the different angles of the halacha. He's learning and reviewing and analyzing, and he can't figure it out. And he tells himself, I wish I had the clarity, I could get to my rebbeim and ask them the question. So there were a few of his brave soldiers that decided to penetrate enemy lines and go and ask the question. So they did it. They didn't ask him. They penetrated enemy lines. They went into the Sanhedrin. They said, we're in the middle of the war. This is the scenario. It'll save us a lot of time and energy. Obviously, they're not going to kill us if we don't do it, but it'll make our lives easier, and are we allowed to do it? They tell them, sure, you're allowed to do it, no problem. They penetrate enemy lines again, they come to King David, and they tell him the halacha. it's not described this way in the Navi. And the Prophet, it's described differently. The Prophet describes that they're in the middle of a war, and King David was dying of thirst. He said, I wish I had a normal cup of water to drink. I wish I could have real fresh water to drink. And his three brave soldiers said, we're going to penetrate enemy lines and get you fresh water. So they penetrated enemy lines. They brought back the fresh water. He took it and said, you risk your lives for this water. I libated it before Hashem and poured it before Hashem and wouldn't drink it. He said, I can't drink your blood. You're giving me, this is your blood in this water. You risked your lives for this cup of water. I can't drink it. So our tradition is that it wasn't water. Water is a metaphor for Torah. This was the halacha they were stuck on. This was what they did. And he said, I can't take your blood for this halacha. So he said, we're pouring it before Hashem. The Gemara says, what does that mean? The Gemara says, he said, even though you were the ones who obtained this psak halacha, and technically for generations we should quote it in your name, we will quote it anonymously. You don't get your names in the Mishnah. Your names will not appear on this halacha. You were wrong in risking your lives on my behalf for this. So,
why?
Because it didn't warrant risking their lives. If it did, he would have sent them. They thought they were doing something extra special for him. And he said, no, you don't risk your lives just because I have a question. I wanted the answer. I needed the answer, but not at the expense of risking your lives. That's very good. But that doesn't mean they're in the right. The fact that God doesn't zap a person doesn't mean he's right.
It wasn't a matter of zapping a person. It was a matter of getting shot with a bow and arrow. It was a matter of being enslaved by a sword. But they did it so that they could bring that halakhic information so they could strategically win the war and make it better.
We don't do God's calculations for him. We don't say if God didn't have him killed, so they were right. We analyze it halakhically. And halakhically, they should not have risked their lives for it.
Why?
Because they shouldn't have risked their lives if, because he had a question. They could have managed without it. And they did. I mean, they would have. There's a general, there's a king there. They're going to call the shots?
That much I understand, okay. But then when the Rabbanim, wouldn't they have told them, like, oh, you shouldn't come here?
I'm not sure they knew all the facts. They weren't there at the battlefield, the Sanhedrin. So that's what I'm saying. From that, we learn that sometimes there is such a concept as blood money, right?
Yeah.
And, so that's what I'm saying. You're telling me that the guy sold drugs, now he wants to give a tithe. I don't know. I wouldn't want to accept it. But maybe I'm wrong. I see I'm answering you a feeling. But halacha, we have to check. We have a mitzvah not to take a loan with interest, and this is an important mitzvah. People sometimes err in this. You're not allowed to pay interest or accept interest. Here we have to pause for a minute. So the Torah tells us that we have a mitzvah not to take a loan with interest, not to give a loan with interest. We have a mitzvah not to delay when we've taken upon ourselves an obligation, a vow. Now that includes sometimes a person tells the poor person, I'll give you a loan next week, or a person dedicates a donation to a shul or some other function, he pledges. So you're not supposed to delay that. You should be quick to pay up your dues. What about buying a house?
Taking a loan with interest.
So how do we do that here in Israel today? In the United States, it's less of an issue because the banks aren't owned by Jews. You're allowed to take a loan and pay interest to a non-Jew. And just like you're allowed to pay him interest, you're allowed to collect from him interest. It goes both ways. But here in Israel, where it's all Jewish-owned, so we have what's called a heter iska. And what a heter iska is basically we form a partnership where he takes a part of the risk. We become partners. And what we're basically saying in a heter iska, let's say I have a business and I want a loan from you of $100,000. Now, what we write up in the heter iska is that you are owed the principal of $100,000 and I am obligated to give you, let's say, $10,000 a year of the profits from this business. That's my obligation to you. So now, I'm not paying you interest because you have a certain risk in the business. You're a partner in the business. But that partnership entitles you to take this much out of the business. So that we frame it that way. We have this concept of a Hetzer Iska that's quoted in the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. I've oversimplified it, but generally what we're doing is we're forming a partnership and you're getting a percentage of the profits, and with that you're actually also getting a part of the risk because you're a partner. So that's the way we set it up today. Every bank you go to in Israel, any bank that deals with mortgages, legally must have a Hetzer Iska. It's part of the law here in Israel, and you could ask them for a copy of it. They'll give you a copy of the...
If you don't have a Hetzer, you can't.
What?
If you don't have a Hetzer, you can't.
Here in Israel, I don't think there is such a bank. Some banks will even send you, when they're doing advertising here in the religious neighborhoods, on the back of their advertising, they send you a copy of that. Look at us, we're super kosher.
I don't understand what the Hetzer Iska is.
What the Hetzer Iska does is it forms a partnership instead of a loan. Instead of his lending me $100,000 and I'm giving him $10,000 a year interest, what happens is he's buying a partnership in my business for his $100,000. I owe him the principal $100,000, but he's going to get $10,000 of the profits every year. So he's now becoming a partner and buying ownership of those profits, or getting entitlement to those profits. It's not that I'm owing him interest. Let's say my business takes his $100,000 and makes another $100,000 with it.
Okay. So $200,000 when you really got a loan of $100,000.
I have the $100,000 I owe him, and I made another $100,000. Okay. We can say I took a loan from him of $100,000. I owe him the $100,000, and I'll pay him interest on that $100,000. That's a classical loan. I took the loan. I owe you the money. You don't own any of my business. You don't have any risk. I personally owe you the $100,000 and interest of $10,000. That's a classical loan. Now let's imagine something else. I have my store, and my store makes on average $100,000 income a year. I'm going to borrow $100,000 from him, and I'm going to tell him, you should know, for your $100,000, you're buying a partnership in my store. And my store is going to, because you're a partner, you're entitled, let's say you bought 100 shares of my store. So that entitles you to $10,000 worth of dividends each year. You're getting $10,000 of the profit each year. Now, I'm not paying him interest anymore. He became a partner. He bought shares with that $100,000. I owe him the principal. He could cash in those shares. But it's no longer in the form of a loan. It's an investment he's made in my business. That's what we're really setting up in a Hetzer Iska.
So how does that work in banks?
So the banks also, when the bank gives you a loan, they're setting it up as in that format. I'm giving you the loan, I'm buying a partnership in whatever you're going to invest that money, and you are taking responsibility to give me a dividend of such and such a year.
What about a house?
So that's a good question. I'm not sure exactly how it's worded, if it's that we're assuming the house will go up in value and that's where you're paying it from. I have to look at it again. The Torah says, even though your employer has to give you food during your employment with his food, yeah, you're not allowed to show up with your axe and your sickle to start harvesting food for yourself. Meaning, you're only allowed to take what you're eating. That's what the Torah says. Take as many grapes as you're hungry for, but don't show up with your axe to start cutting down baskets full of grapes to eat beyond what you really need to eat. That's a special biblical prohibition pertaining to that mitzvah. We have a biblical prohibition not to take...
Is that again? Sorry, just if someone owes you food?
No, if you're working for someone in the food industry,
okay,
you're harvesting his grapes for him. So, technically, we learned he's supposed to allow you to eat from those grapes as you're harvesting the grapes. Comes the Torah and says, but you are prohibited from showing up with an axe. You're prohibited from showing up and saying, okay, you got to feed me as I'm working. Come, here's my basket. I'm just going to take... You're supposed to eat what you're going to eat now while you work. Not to clean them out.
So you're allowed to eat.
But you're... Yeah.
When you're on the field working.
So we said, you shouldn't do it as you're working. You should do it during the break time.
But then you have to...
Right. So yes, that's a discussion in the Mishnayos. Very nice. About Trumas and Maestros involves too many details. In general, you're not chayv in Truma and Maestros till you finish really working with the food, right? So it's not going to come up so often, but technically, we assume that the owner is going to take off Drumas and Maisers once it's responsible for it. And if he doesn't, so then there's a discussion in the Mishnah whether you can or cannot. In general, yeah, but it's an oversimplification. Because again, very often it won't be relevant because the food isn't finished yet. We said when you take collateral, there's a mitzvah not to take something that he uses for his livelihood. Don't take a taxi driver's taxi. If he offers it, so we said, you just have to bring it back in time for him to work. There's a mitzvah if a person has the blemishes of tzaras, not to slice them off, not to pull them off. Well, a regular scab you could, but if it's one of those white blemishes, then you cannot.
You don't have tzaras at all? There's no whatsoever?
We don't know what it is anymore. We have a mitzvah in the Torah, if someone owes you money, don't take collateral by force. Meaning, prior to the loan, you could tell him, you want the loan, give me collateral. When the loan is up, you could tell him, you didn't pay, give me collateral. You could take him to court, and the court will demand he gives collateral. But you cannot walk into his house and walk off with things and say, ah, now I took collateral. There's a special mitzvah in the Torah, don't walk into his house. You stand outside.
Specifically for collateral?
Yes. Now, the Torah also gives us a special prohibition not to withhold the collateral when he needs it. If you took from him collateral, you took schach for his sukkah. Now he needs it. You took collateral, you took his bed. And at night he needs it. So the Torah prohibits withholding it at a time that he needs it. Not only for his livelihood, even a regular need.
If he has two beds, can you take his best bed?
Okay. I don't know. But we learned the details of these laws in the Avat Chesed, in the Chafetz Chaim. You could look it up there. We have a mitzvah in the Torah not to allow close relatives to testify. We have a mitzvah not to favor the orphans or the gerim in court, even though we're supposed to be extra kind to them. But in court, justice is justice, and you're not allowed to play favorites.
So interesting.
Yeah.
So the judge then completely forgets about the mitzvah of Ahavta Tagar.
Right, right. But it makes a lot of sense. Otherwise, he can't have justice, right? We have a mitzvah that says, don't take collateral from a widow. An extra special mitzvah to have compassion over the widow. Discussion among our sages whether, if the widow is wealthy, whether you're allowed to do it or not. And here we have a very important machlokes. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says, Del Shinan Taima Dikra, that one of the licenses that the Torah gave the sages is to apply a reason to a mitzvah in the Torah, even though the Torah didn't give that reason, and that reason will have halachic implications. How so? So Rabbi Shimon says, why aren't you allowed to take collateral from a widow? Because if she's a poor widow, you're going to come back every night to give her back her blanket or something else. People are going to start talking, why is he at that widow's house every evening? So what happens if it's a wealthy widow, and you don't have to bring her back the collateral every night? Says Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, a big chidush, you're allowed to take collateral. So he gave a reasoning behind the mitzvah in the Torah, and then he says, now, the halachic implications of that reasoning, well, they fall in line too. So that's a big machlokas that stems from this, big machlokas in the Mishnah. We have a mitzvah when giving lashes to be careful not to give even one extra. So you're very careful to give the right amount. Directly after the mitzvah of giving lashes, the Torah says, Lo tachsom shol b'disho. Do not muzzle an ox as it's threshing. And from here we derive, threshing is as it's walking around to break the grain. So you have to allow it to eat. It's seeing the grains on the floor all around it. They had these platforms where you wanted to break the chaff off the kernel. So an ox would walk around and the kernels would be bumping up and down on that platform. It was an uneven platform. And through their bumping up and down, so the chaff would break off. And then you'd take the kernels and throw them in the wind, and the chaff would blow away, and the kernels would fall to the ground. So that's those are stages of processing the wheat. So the animal's walking around, and all it sees in front of its face is all those kernels of food. The Torah says you're not allowed to muzzle it as it's doing that. Now, we take that prohibition as the prototypical muzzle. Shut its mouth. the prototypical prohibition that gets lashes, meaning the juxtaposition in the Torah of giving lashes and don't muzzle your animal, teaches us that when does one get lashes? When he transgresses a prohibition that's similar to the prohibition of muzzling an animal. How so?
I have a question about this actually.
Yes. Assuming he was warned, assuming the warning was correct and there were two witnesses, but the prohibition of muzzling an animal is an active prohibition, meaning you have to do an act in order to transgress. Sometimes you have a lav she'ein bo maiseh, a prohibition which you transgress without any action. You can just transgress it without doing anything. What would be an example of that?
I just have a quick question. So I was at a friend's house and he had horses. And so I was riding on one of the horses and he had kind of like a, not exactly a muzzle, but like a bar in his mouth.
A bit, yeah.
So like every once in a while you just stop and there's hay and you try to eat the hay.
That's not this, right?
Okay.
And even here, if you wanted to put a basket in front of its face with barley, so you didn't muzzle it. Anytime one sees it, eats the barley. It sees the grain. It sees your wheat. Fine.
You muzzle it with
you didn't muzzle it. You put a basket around its neck. You put a basket with barley. Anytime it wants to eat, it'll eat the barley. Yeah.
Abraham muzzled his sheep.
Not like a bad.
So he wouldn't eat other human breath.
I said you can muzzle your animal.
No, I understand that. But now, if Abraham was on his own grass,
right?
Would he be permitted to muzzle his animal if they wouldn't eat?
I think so. Yeah. The idea is when you're doing an action, that they're all the time seeing the food and you're withholding it from them, that's not right. If on your own field, for whatever reason, you want to muzzle your animal, you may, and sometimes you even have to. One of the mitzvahs in the Torah is, do not leave something dangerous in your home. So what's considered something dangerous? An open socket or a dog that could bite people. You have to muzzle it. So, yeah. Right.
Can't keep those in your home?
Well, you can't keep them in a way that they can cause harm. You have to keep them in a way they can't cause harm. You're not allowed to leave something that can potentially cause harm. So that means...
What about a gun?
Pretty much anything.
Same thing. Yeah.
But if you have it locked up, like...
You have to have it in a way that won't cause any harm. Now, the issue with a gun, is it depends a little bit. Some people leave a gun cocked. There's always a bullet in the barrel. So then all someone has to do is pull the trigger and it shoots. So that's much more serious. Some people leave the gun where it's not. Then the kid would have to really learn how to cock a gun, load and cock the gun, and release the safety latch. So that, still, I think that kids are very smart and kids learn very fast. I recommend that most people not have guns in their homes because most people aren't safe enough with them. A lot of people get killed from accidents with guns, and if a person's going to have a gun at home, then he better have a safe to put it in, and he better know himself well enough to know that he will never leave that gun lying around. Now, obviously, you can't say a blanket statement. Some people live in neighborhoods where they must have a gun. Some people have people threatening their lives, and they must have a gun. The average person, if they carry a gun around, so the problem arises if they start playing around with the gun. That's dangerous, then they shouldn't own a gun. Or if they are like most people, that they sometimes forget their keys on the table, and they're going to forget their gun on the table. And it only takes once. And that's why I would strongly recommend, first of all, not leaving it loaded. And secondly, for most people, it's not right to have a gun. It's more danger having it than not having it. For most people, saying,
people living in the Shabbat.
That's a good question. If a person's living out in Yesha, he should ask his local Orthodox rabbi. There's a discussion among rabbis what's right. And a lot of it depends on the individual. I think the statistics show that more people get hurt by owning guns than get saved by owning guns. You hear the twice a year where a terrorist gets killed by a gun. But you don't hear the, I don't know how many times a year, where people get hurt by the guns that they have in their home. So I didn't know that this statistic was true here in Israel, but I was told that this is true here in Israel. In the United States, for sure, that's true. In Israel, I thought everyone does the army, so those people that have guns usually have done the army, and then there's no problem because they know what they're doing with the gun. They're not just playing with it. But I was told, a friend of mine told me that it's not so. A friend of mine who deals in guns a little bit, and he told me, no, the statistics here are that there are many, many, many injuries and fatalities from gun owners here, and very few instances where people's lives are saved by the gun, compared to the fatalities. So I don't know, you know, halacha l'maisa, you have to check the exact statistics, but generally that's something to consider very heavily. We have a mitzvah not to leave in our home scales that are off scale. You're not allowed to leave something dishonest in your home, meaning if you have scales that are off, you're not allowed to leave them lying around. You have to fix them or get rid of them.
But if you have like a hook or
Eifa and Evan, both. It says, Lo yevach ischa, Eifa ve'Eifa, Lo yevach Evan ve'Aven. Well, one's a measurement and one's a scale. One's a measurement of volume, one's a measurement of weight. We're discussing owning guns and the danger of it. And we just discussed that you're not allowed to leave in your home dishonest measurements. Right. Scales and measurements, right.
Specifically for the, like for sale that marriage stuff for parnasa and stuff like that, like not to cheat people.
So no, the Torah prohibits it even if you're not doing business right now.
Right.
Even though right now you don't have a business, but you have a scale that's off. We're not talking about a scale where you weigh your weight. You have a scale that's used for business. You have measurements that are off. So you're not supposed to leave them lying around the house.
What about a clock that's like not the right time?
A clock that's not the right time. That's an interesting question. So I don't think it falls under this category. But that's an interesting question. We once got a clock that had a very nice inscription on it. A whole piece that was inscribed on it. And it stopped working. Huh?
Like a poem?
Yeah, a poem that was written all around the clock. So we liked the poem, and we liked the person who gave the gift. So we left it hanging. And we never looked at it as a clock anymore, because to us, we knew it didn't work. We had guests over, and they're sitting there. And 3 hours later, he looks at his watch, and he says, oh my God, it's already 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I thought it was 10 in the morning. And I'm looking at he says, that clock hasn't moved in 3 hours. Okay, so then I learned, like you're saying, sometimes even a clock that's off can mislead someone. But I don't know if that falls off. I don't know if that falls under this category. But I don't know, because the Gemara tells us that even if you have a potty that has a measurement on it that's off, meaning originally it was used as a measuring instrument, now it's used as a potty, what are the chances you're going to use that to measure your wine anymore? You're not, right? And even so, the Gemara says you shouldn't leave it lying around because it has a measurement that's off. So I'm not sure practically where we would limit the application to this. I don't know. Yeah?
I think I got a little bit late. You did give him already?
Yeah.
What happens if he wants to and she doesn't? He wants to go take her as a wife and she doesn't?
So the Talmud says that this is where we ask the rabbis to intervene and the rabbis will outsmart him. The Talmud says there were stories where... he was a gangster. And she said, I don't want to be married to him. So the rabbis told him, look, here's the deal. You do chalitza, and then in 3 months, we'll be able to do yibum. I mean, they tricked him. Basically, they misinformed him. They got him to free her. I mean, this is where the court has to use... should be in yivamot. I think it's in yivamot, yeah.
Thank you.
So...